Hi, this is Joe Shirey. I'm here at TechEd in New Orleans this week, and today I've got with me Lauren Goodman. Lauren's with Inroll. He's the CTO of Inroll, and today we're going to talk a little bit about things like business logic. So welcome, Lauren. It's great to have you here.
It's very good to be here. Thank you.
So one of the things, and Lauren and I have known each other for a long time, and we've had a lot of these conversations over a beverage.
Adult beverages.
But one of the things that I know Lauren's really passionate about is business logic and that separation of business logic and kind of its own layer. And so first thing I'd ask you, Lauren, is that I know you're really passionate about it.
Yes.
So kind of tell me why passionate about it. Where did that come from, and what have you seen in terms of value that you have if you start to really separate out that business logic?
That's a great question. I'm very happy to be here. The business logic separation, in watching programming language mature over time, and I've been programming quite a few years, and watching it mature over time, we started off with creating of ways of abstracting how this computer worked with going from assembly to C to other higher level languages. And then we sort of went sideways with things like subroutines and functions. And then we started making layers with databases and code. Mm-hmm. And now we have UI. And business logic became the thing that was actually something that could be separated and abstracted. And that started with a passion for metadata, which we're well aware of,
mm-hmm.
and then realizing that the logic of an application is metadata just as much as the application itself.
Right.
And so coming up with ways of abstracting that, when you empower people and you give them ownership and you put them in charge of a particular aspect, they just go to such an insane degree of effort to make it perfect. And for example, in a call center, I saw a rule that was, this is on the edge of the call center, you're on the phone, and the person was able to say, oh, I'm sorry, you know, your order's going to be 2 weeks late because the manufacturer, actually, they have fire, and because of that fire, they delayed shipping, and I'm really sorry. That was actually the output of a business rule that said, if the product is this,
right,
tell the customer that.
Right.
Makes it all the way to the edge. And there's a customer who understands and doesn't feel, sorry, order delayed.
Correct. Yeah, I can understand that.
So, yeah, the, it's just the tooling around it has been very difficult. There's a lot of people out there when you say, I want to empower subject matter experts to maintain the business logic, and they say that's impossible.
Right.
There were a lot of people who probably were assembly programmers who said, you can't make a higher level language, you'll never control the computer correctly. I don't know if those people existed, but I'm assuming that they did.
Yes.
And I think that it's a matter of, the onus is on us as developers, is how do we create the tooling that actually lets them maintain what's important to them and not have to cope with what's not. And it's not an easy problem to solve, but we're making great steps towards it.
So when you bring this up, the subject matter experts on one side,
right,
the developers on the other side,
right?
Right? And we all know that the developers are trying to interpret what the subject matter experts are saying and turn that into usable systems. And sometimes it works, and a lot of times it doesn't work.
Right.
What do you think culturally kind of causes that impedance mismatch in terms of developer versus subject matter expert?
You know, it's interesting and that's a great question. If you look at new hires,
mm-hmm.
So if I go into a client, I kind of spend half my time internally on the technology vision and architecture there, and the other half is really going out and in the trenches. I want to work with customers. I want to see the problems they're facing. I want to communicate design techniques.
Right.
And so one of the things I've noticed is if you have a new analyst and a new programmer, they have zero problems.
Right.
You know, and what happens is over time, there'll be that one meeting, that one time, when that programmer misinterpreted something,
mm-hmm.
and they had a meeting, and all of a sudden, the finger was pointed at them.
Right.
And the human reaction is, you know, to defend yourself when attacked.
Mm-hmm.
And that defense, unfortunately, comes off as an attack.
Right.
So take people who've been working together for 15 years, and how much of that animosity is built up over time.
Mm-hmm.
And I think those factors contribute more to the inefficiency of the cycle than anything else, because when people join the first day, they want to get the program done.
Right.
In fact, I have a client made a great quote to his team. I've used this plenty of times. He said to his team, so they had a reorg, and he had the analyst group, so they reorganized and separated analysts. They used to have separate analysts and dev.
Mm-hmm.
They united them around business verticals. So he had this group of analysts and this group of devs. And mind you, this isn't an insurance company, so there's some history there, right?
Right.
And so he had in his meeting, he said, listen, you know what? You guys don't make documents anymore, and you guys don't make code. We build applications.
Right.
Whatever barriers exist, we're going to break them down and approach this so that we are building the application as a team and we all are equally responsible. So often it's the developers get the credit for making the application,
mm-hmm.
when in fact the analysts you know, have more blood, sweat, and tears into that process than almost anyone else. And they really get mistreated. So
a lot of times I see that they're the ones who are actually creating a lot of the business value alignment.
Yeah.
Right? Because they're understanding the business component of things and they're able to communicate how it's going to solve a business problem or how it's going to make the company more money or save money or one of those things.
Yes.
Now, one of the things when we talked about the product that you helped design and build in Rules Engine,
right.
One of the value propositions of that is being able to take pieces of what was developed in the past and bringing it out and giving it to subject matter experts and letting them start to develop some of the business logic within the system.
If I follow you correctly, you're saying taking an existing application and extracting out or...
Well, I'm saying taking the ability to write pieces of code that it gets...
Outsourcing development. Gotcha.
Yes.
Okay.
So it's no longer just a pure developer
task.
You know, we're able to shift some of that out into the people who know the business, the best, and know what they want. They're the ones making those decisions in a lot of cases.
Correct.
I know when I've been around developers before, that they get nervous whenever people who are not developers are writing anything that would be used to actually execute within a system.
Yes.
So that's another cultural shift that you've probably seen multiple times. I'm kind of curious of your perspective on that and what's worked, what's not worked, and how you kind of get over the hump of that trust relationship.
That's a really tough problem.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny is that developers don't get credit for having business insights. When the fact is, if I'm especially, again, I don't mean to pick on insurance companies. If I really want to find out the business logic of an insurance company, mm-hmm. I go out to lunch with one of their mainframers.
Mm-hmm.
They know the business logic better than the analysts, better than the subject matter experts, because they've been doing it for so long.
Right.
That's really never filtered uphill. And so I think developers aren't given credit for having a business insight about anything. And because we as developers think very logically. We think with, you know, contained variables. We think with parameters. So we're very good at communicating context to one another.
Mm-hmm.
However, a subject matter expert, that context is actually substantially more complex than ours. And so because it can't be broken down quite as easily, they're somehow seen as less capable of thinking about their problem than we are, when in fact, my guess is they actually know their problem substantially better than developers do, and it's all that communication.
Right.
I don't know if time is the factor that's going to fix it. I mean, I'm sure that, like, if you follow typesetting in that process.
Mm-hmm.
So originally you would go, if I wanted to print a banner, I would sit down with a typesetter and say, I'm thinking about banner.
Right.
Here's what I want to do, right? And they'd say, okay, I'll come back in a few days with some thought. And they make a sketch of your banner, show it to you, and you'd be like, oh, it looks good, right?
Right.
Then they'd go to build in a typesetting machine, which was all these little stick of gum type things with little letters on the top. But they wouldn't have the font that they actually sketched. So they'll use a different one.
Mm-hmm.
But then, oh, geez, we don't have this dash line. We're going to use a straight line and all these other things. So then finally when you get it, it's not what the sketch looked like, which the sketch didn't quite represent what you wanted. And then when word processors came out, typesetters were, people can't make their own documents. They'll never figure it out. How can they possibly do that?
Mm-hmm.
And what happened is, and if you remember, I'm far too young to remember these things, but the markup code word processing, right? That's where I grew up. And when they took the markup codes out, and all of a sudden the stuff on the screen was actually bold, that connection, it totally empowered people to do more than typesetters would ever do for them, because they were having a first-person trial-and-error experience of building what they want.
Right.
And how to mature to the point from the first word processor to what we have today with, like, Microsoft Word took 20 years.
Yep.
And I think that's kind of where we're at, only that was 20 years for a very narrow business context,
mm-hmm.
and every single context is different, so I just think it's a matter of time.
So when you start talking about the partnership between these two, you have some techniques to help facilitate that partnership, to make that so it's not, you know, so much of this, but more of a give-get type of approach. Can you tell me a little bit about what you do there from a facilitation perspective to kind of make that work?
Well, that's my favorite aspect of anything I get to do.
Mm-hmm.
I have this thing I call the handshake. I believe shaking hands is a very core human experience.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of like when you meet somebody new, you shake their hand. When you do anything or you complete a deal, you get up and you shake each other's hands. You see a friend, you say goodnight, you shake their hand.
Right.
And so by bringing that, the strength of that metaphor into the business space,
mm-hmm.
and saying, look, the problem is really not that both of you want to make this software awesome. Because you do.
Right.
The problem is, you've both been burned so many times that you actually put a lot of energy into making sure you're not at fault. Mm-hmm. Instead of climbing out on a limb and saying, you know, it's much more efficient to try three things and pick the best than it is to spend 6 months figuring out which one would be the best if you were to try it.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that meeting, I like to get the subject matter expert and the developer to agree on what I call vocabulary.
Right.
And not vocabulary in like that we're going to use English. Mm-hmm. Vocabulary in the sense that there's a finite set of phrases that exist in order to communicate intent.
Mm-hmm.
So one could look at it in a data entry application. The screen is the vocabulary of the order.
Right.
Right. It's got these boxes, and I really can't say anything outside of that.
Right.
That doesn't really exist for the requirements process.
Mm-hmm.
And so by building this vocabulary and enforcing it with a tool like InRule, the only point of this contention between the two can be the vocabulary is not there.
Right.
But the other big piece of that is your unit testing surface dramatically shrinks. This came from Jim Wilt, who among the 8 million brilliant things he's had to say, one of them was that when he looked at testing surface and he drew a little graph, and he was talking about instance and pattern. I don't know if you remember, but it was really cool. He's like, so if I have this, I have to test this case, which says, does this particular unit do this, 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 and this?
Mm-hmm.
If you take that graph and break it into this vocabulary communication, your testing surface is now minuscule comparatively, because now I have to just test, did I interpret the vocabulary right? Did I interpret the vocabulary right? Did I interpret the vocabulary right?
Gotcha.
Did I call it right? Did I call it right? Did I call it right?
Mm-hmm.
And now, I mean, literally, you reduce testing by 99%.
Wow.
And I mean, in fact, I mean, we have a lot of clients who have come back and said, we've cut maintenance by 95%.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
Very impressive. So, well, Lauren, thanks for coming out today. Appreciate the time.
Pleasure to be here.
So, we'll talk soon, and we'll end with
the handshake. There you go.
Take care.
Thanks.